we go to one out of three meetings,
mm-hmm.
it goes down. You're at all of them.
No, that's the game.
That's how it works, true. Yeah. Well, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
So we'll probably, the idea is just to have a conversation and record it, and then we'll transcribe and do the, you know,
good.
Edited Q&A as people do. But mostly it's going to be you're talking about things you want to talk about, things that we want to talk about,
great.
And we can go back and forth. Feel free to interrupt anybody, whenever that works.
Great.
So let's start with just your sense of what the idea of the candidacy is. What is your animating force here? What's the story of your campaign?
The animating force writ large is about solving the community's problems. The community's not lacking for smart candidates. It's not lacking for 10-point plans. It's not lacking for top three priorities or first 100-day strategies. It's lacking leadership. And the problems that seem to be catching the city by surprise are problems that have been with us for a long time. They've been building, and they have now reached a crisis stage. So my theory for running is that we already know what the questions are that the next mayor needs to address. There are lots of people moving to our community. Where are they going to live? Where are they going to work? How are they going to get around, given that we're not building more infrastructure? How do we maintain and expand infrastructure opportunities that we already have? How do we protect the livability of the community? How do we protect the environment that we live in? And with the current urgent issues, how do we begin to address the homelessness crisis, which, by the way, was not an emergency until I got in the race and made it an emergency, or the housing affordability issue, which had only been partially talked about. The city council has finally adopted some strategies to improve and streamline and lower the cost of bringing workforce and affordable housing back online. We're 6 years into an economic recovery, and lots of people aren't participating in that recovery. And it seems like we're missing the bigger picture about how to connect people to the education and skills training required in an increasingly skills-based economy. And infrastructure, you know this as good as well as anybody. This has been a problem 20 years in the making, and yet the city is acting as though it's surprised. So I guess if I had to say one thing, I'm running for mayor so our city can stop being surprised and being reactive to the crisis du jour, and instead focus on providing the kind of leadership to get ahead of the curve again and to be deliberate in the strategy and helping to build the kind of community we want to live in. Mm-hmm. And specific to what you want to talk about, you're interested in the question of, you know, alternative modes of transportation to vehicles. This is really important. If 300,000 people are going to be moving to Portland and we're not building more roads and we're not building more infrastructure, the question then becomes, how do we create the kind of infrastructure that makes it work?
Mm-hmm.
And
how do we create the kind of infrastructure that makes it work?
Well, first of all, let's prioritize. It was prioritized, and now it's not.
Mm-hmm.
When Sam Adams was the mayor, it was a priority. It was a clear priority. It was a stated priority.
It was? What was? Sorry.
Sam Adams, when he was a mayor, championed the separation of bicycle from traffic. He also improved, in my opinion, through the Greenway program, pedestrian safety, what's the name of it? The Walk to Schools program. Safe Routes to Schools program was something he championed so that within basically a mile radius of every school, you'd have bikeability, you'd have walkability, you'd have safe crosswalks.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was smart. Jonathan gave me a little bit of a ribbing the other day online, but I'm going to stick to my guns. When you have the neighborhood greenways program and you connect them and you have the bicycle throughways and you've reduced the volume of traffic, you're creating not only safety for bicycles and more certainty for automobiles, because people who drive don't want to be hitting bicycles, you're also creating safer crossings for older adults and kids who are going to school. And there is an opportunity, and this is what I meant in my answer, there's an opportunity in places where we don't really have a whole lot of green space to include things like microparks. Mm-hmm. It's a very low-cost option to bring.
Like Holman or something like
exactly,
that.
Exactly, right. To bring some canopy into a neighborhood, and it's also traffic calming. It also helps, you know, with the safety of intersections. So there, you know, there are opportunities there. That's what I was referencing. Jonathan didn't have a chance to talk to me about it.
Sure, sure, yeah.
But that's what, you know, I was referring to.
No, glad to put it on the record. That makes sense. You said that we have to anticipate the crises rather than react to them. What are the crises we're not even reacting to right now? What are the crises that are coming in the future?
The homelessness situation until... weeks ago, the city was saying it stabilized. I call bullshit on the table on that one. I think it's gotten a lot worse. And if you go and you talk to people at Central City Concern or New Avenues for Youth or Outside In, they'll tell you we're seeing not only the chronic homeless that have been around for a long time, we're seeing more families with little kids, we're seeing more people of color, we're seeing more couples. We're seeing more older adults, and there's a diversity of reasons why people are homeless. But I think only recently did the city really wake up to the reality that it is a crisis, that it is an emergency. And on day one when I got into the campaign, I said that the homelessness crisis was the number one issue facing this city. And the newspaper at which I made that pronouncement, they had to ask me twice, because they couldn't believe I was serious about homelessness being the number one issue confronting the city of Portland. And I believe it is. Yeah. I believe it's a humanitarian crisis. I believe it's a moral imperative that we address it.
What do you think caused it?
You know, I think it's a combination of things. First of all, there's no question that the collapse of the global economy has led to more people being... economically forced out. The cost of housing is going up five times faster than wages in this community. Even if we'd gotten to the $15 an hour minimum wage today, that only gets you at 40% MFI, which means you still effectively need subsidized housing to be able to live in the city of Portland. Of course, minimum wage is nowhere near that point. So that's a part of it. Another part of it is our nation's failure to address mental health issues. We still associate mental health issues with or ascribe a stigma to it. We have not really owned the problem. We haven't funded it or supported it at the community level as though we believe it is the widespread crisis that it is. There's no question that drug and alcohol addiction is contributing. Meth has made a comeback. Heroin is more prevalent than it's been in many years. There's more youth on the street. Some of them are, I'd forget the percentage, but a large percentage self-identify as LGBT youth. I want to say it's somewhere near half.
Sure.
And a lot of them have been kicked out of their homes. Others have abusive or neglectful backgrounds, and some come from the foster care system. So there, there's
lots of different problems manifesting in similar ways
that require different answers.
Sure,
One size does not fit all.
That makes sense. Let's stick with housing. What are the sort of routes? Specifically, we talk about the affordability crisis. Usually our sort of angle on that is talking about affordable proximity, right? How do you get not only general affordability, general wage to housing cost ratios healthy, but also how do you get if somebody wants the option to live close to the places they work or shop or go to school or whatever, how do you make it possible for more people to be able to do that?
Well, if I had to sort of start at the top of the pyramid, the long-term planning has to take into account that housing, community centers, and places of employment need to be in close proximity. I support the urban growth boundary, FYI. I think you should probably start at that broad level. Density isn't necessarily a bad thing. Density is efficient. It's more sustainable. It allows us to live in a more compact environment with a smaller carbon footprint. it gives us the opportunity to create these livable, walkable, bikeable communities. Mm-hmm. But that's just the vision. The reality is people are moving east to chase housing affordability. A lot of the jobs, mm-hmm. particularly low-income jobs, are west.
Right.
And so we're creating the situation where people who are poor or lower income are moving farther and farther away from their place of employment and into areas that have worse transit. And you know, certainly that does nothing but contribute to congestion and economic problems for families that can least afford those kinds of problems. So, that's
so what's the answer, I guess?
Well, there's a lot of answers. Number one, let's make sure that at the J-PACT and the MPACT table, we're actually co-locating town centers and employment opportunities close to where people are living. That's mm-hmm. sort of thing number one. Thing number two is look at our own policies around housing and see whether they're consistent with the espoused value of letting people who work in our community actually be able to afford to live in our community. We still, in many circumstances, outlaw duplexes, triplexes. Garden apartments haven't been legal for a long time mm-hmm. in this community. Smaller, denser, lower cost options are in high demand right now, and yet our own zoning codes don't allow for the kind of housing situations that a lot of people, frankly, would clamor for if they had the opportunity, that are more affordable. The second area, and Commissioner Saltzman, I think, has begun to address this really well, is how the city's own policies around design review, permitting, the inspection process can sometimes contribute to both the length of time and the cost of getting housing online. Mm-hmm. I, of course, testified at the legislature in support of inclusionary zoning. I thought that was a very important tool for us. We got less than what I would have wanted. Mm-hmm. What I was hoping for was we would just lift the prohibition. Mm-hmm. That's what I asked for. That's what I testified in favor of. They mm-hmm. didn't do that. They decided to give us a prescription, which, we're going to have to spend some time to figure out what we can actually do with that.
Sure.
And, the wage piece of this is important, too. You know, part of, you know, there's the supply of housing right. side, but there's also the wage side. And I would argue that we hear very little about that mm-hmm. from policy leaders. You know, the standard I'm hearing at the presidential level on down is, I'm going to create good middle-class jobs. Mm-hmm. Well, the reality is, in Portland, people have been saying that for how many generations? And the reality is we have a lot of low-paying, low-skilled jobs and a lot of high-skill, high-wage jobs
right.
and very few
right.
middle-class jobs. And the few that we have, the preponderance of middle-class sustaining jobs that do not require a college education are in the Columbia Corridor in the Portland Harbor. Mm-hmm. And so, but if you overlay the housing maps, you're going to see that the people who work in those areas, in those blue-collar middle-class jobs, are actually being forced to move farther and farther
right.
east.
Right.
So, my argument has been that we will have more high-skill, high-wage jobs in this community. Just in construction and healthcare alone, there'll mm-hmm. be 25,000 new jobs by 2025 that pay more than $25 an hour.
Are we on course for that already, or does something need
Absolutely.
To change?
Absolutely. That's organic okay. growth.
So we've already got that.
But the question is, will people have the job training and the education required to take those jobs? Mm-hmm. And the answer as of today is no. We will not be on track for local people to be qualified and educated for those jobs,
okay.
which means they'll be recruiting from sure. outside the community to fill those jobs. That's I haven't even talked about technology yet.
Right.
That's just construction and healthcare.
Okay.
So when we have a public education system where a lot of kids aren't graduating, we know that you know, 26% that aren't graduating on time, if they actually turn out not to get a high school diploma,
mm-hmm.
they're over here.
Yeah.
Lower skill, lower wage. They're yeah. stuck. So we're already doing a disservice to a lot of young people. And for those who do go on, the question is, are we going to have pathways to advanced education, job training, programs at PCC, private sector, union training programs that'll skill people for the kind of employment opportunities that'll exist here in the future.
That's all super important. And
very.
I don't want to detract from it. We should get back to transportation to some
sure.
extent. On the you mentioned the sort of infill residential development.
Yes.
Would you envision that duplexes, garden apartments in all R5 or some R5? How do you reach that balance?
So right now, I believe, and I'm no great expert on this, in R5 you can do a duplex on a corner.
As long as they're facing in different directions.
I think that's right.
Yeah,
yeah, I think that's right. And the question is it really detrimental to the community, given that we want more density, given that we want more affordable housing,
mm-hmm.
to allow that in other areas? I think the answer is absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And garden apartments, which, by the way, were...
Absolutely, it is good for the community, not detrimental.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah, in my opinion.
Right.
And then there's the basic stuff that's already allowed that we're not even implementing particularly well. You know, auxiliary dwelling units, ADUs, granny flats.
Right.
That is a city policy at this point. I think it's a great policy in terms of appropriate density in neighborhoods that fits in with the character of the neighborhood. It's relatively low cost, allows for what I would describe as thoughtful and appropriate infill. You have the city over here pushing it. You have the county tax assessor saying,
right.
but if you do it, I'm going to reassess your primary residence.
Right.
And so you have these examples of people, you know, spending $170,000, $200,000 on an ADU,
right.
and seeing their property taxes go up fourfold.
Right.
That's, you know, I think part of the job of mayor is to help bring together, you know, not only the regional level, but the planning and transportation level, but also at the local level, trying to write some of these policies that are working at cross purposes.
I don't mean to get too far afield, but I'm curious, back with your background, do you have any vision for how we get to the root problem of that, which is, I think, the 90s measures creating the tax inequality?
Absolutely.
Right? So, like,
yeah, 547,
so
50
this,
property.
Obviously, the city would love to get that fixed somehow, but, like, is there a path to getting there?
Well, that's a good question. The answer is yes, there's a path to getting there. The question is there a political will to get there?
Yeah,
I've
so
been talking
losers.
About property tax inequity since at least 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a problem that only will get worse with time.
Right.
Compression will only get worse with
right.
time, meaning you'll see more jurisdictions sharing not truly a shrinking pie, but a pie with a shrinking growth rate, which is going to create problems
sure.
for all of the overlapping jurisdictions.
It also creates more and more of a penalty for redevelopment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And with regards to Measures 5, 47, and 50, there's no question that they have strangled the ability of government to provide the kinds of services that people say they want and expect.
So what can we do, given the fact that there are so many people whose taxes would go up under this and have already bought into the system?
Could you be more specific? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, there are a bunch of people who are going to scream bloody murder if you equalize the taxes overnight, and there are a bunch of people who would be overjoyed, right? So, like, how do you... Do you just
then,
hit
then
those
don't,
people against
don't,
each other? Or
don't let the perfect get in the way of the good. I mean, on,
yeah.
you know, I launched this campaign on day one. I supported a gas tax. That's very unpopular. People don't like taxes.
And
they
we should
like,
get back to that soon, I promise. I'm just curious about this stuff.
Yeah, we will. But it's, you know, we have watched our ability to fund infrastructure in Portland, in Oregon, and frankly nationally
mm-hmm.
deteriorate.
Right.
Congress has not been doing their job. The state legislature, you know, God bless them, they're my friends, all got together last year and said their number one priority, the one thing D's and R's all agreed on, was the transportation package that ultimately
right.
they did not pass.
Right.
Here at the local level, I've said we've got to do our part too. And I have supported Steve Novick and his efforts around the gas tax. I was there before the mayor. I was there before the city council. Was not a popular position. But now it seems like it's, at least in the short term, it throws us a life ring.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a good long-term solution. Long-term solution, we better be talking about carbon taxes. We better be talking about regional and statewide solutions that actually can raise the kind of funds to support our infrastructure.
Do you think there's appetite for anything else at the local level?
Depends what it's for. I always believe at the local level, if you can make a value proposition, people will hear it out. People in Portland are pretty smart. They're mm-hmm. sophisticated voters. And if you give them a chance, they'll hear you out. So the question is, if you're going to tax me, what do I get in exchange? What's the value proposition? People know we have a problem with infrastructure in this mm-hmm. community. I mean, you can look out your door and you can see the problem, whether you walk, particularly in East Portland. I mean, when I mm-hmm. co-convened the East Portland Action Plan with Jeff Merkley and Tom Potter, people were already up in arms about the lack of sidewalks, street crossings that repeatedly had accidents. It's terrible for bicyclists. It's terrible for people who walk. And it's terrible for drivers. I mean, mm-hmm. as far Absolutely. As basic safety goes, it's a really ugly situation. And so, you know, I believe if you make a case to the voters and sell them a specific package, if it's the package they want, they'll support it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just say, hey, I want more money.
Sure, yeah. You know, so what's the package you think people want?
I'll tell you what people are telling me. Number one, safety. No mm-hmm. question about it. Sidewalks, crosswalks, we need more separated bicycle lanes. And what I mean by separated, I mean physically separated.
So you say number one is safety. More than half of the gas tax is going to maintenance. That's sort of an artificial divide, I realize. But the
you know,
how do you square that?
You need all of the above.
Mm-hmm.
Our streets are falling apart,
right.
which certainly isn't a good thing today. And we need more new infrastructure. I mean, I'm actually really proud of what I've been able to accomplish around infrastructure on 148th, the Selwood Bridge, working to complete the Savi Island Bridge. In every one of those cases, I think they were a big win for infrastructure, for bikers, for people who walk, mm-hmm. and for people who need to transit by car.
Right.
I think we did a good job. Selwood Bridge is actually rail capable. So mm-hmm. when the time comes that we're ready to connect east and west over there, we've already got the infrastructure in place to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
So
after we did the tour, Ted looked at me and my girlfriend and said something. It was like, did you notice how wide the sidewalks were on the shoulder?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
on the
huge.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's like, we're going to get a light rail next.
We actually looked at putting the bike and the walk separated underneath the span, and we rejected it. On the grounds that we thought there might be a public safety issue there at night. But we looked at different configurations. We worked with the community. You guys were at the table. I mean, there were a lot of people involved in that process.
Just before we got here on value statement, we were talking about a compelling package, Vision Zero,
mm-hmm.
which seems like if you want people to get behind something, that seems like pretty much
everyone's behind.
Yeah,
people are
Vision
behind
Zero.
It. Yeah. People are behind it. You know, it's... The thing I like about Vision Zero is you know, first of all, it's a community-wide effort. It's not government just regulating. Regulating is certainly a piece of it, but it's mm-hmm. also about the infrastructure. It's about education. It's about bringing the community along to make the community safer, more walkable, and more livable.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that as our city is growing, that's the opportunity through SDCs and through other development fees to start making that kind of infrastructure happen in our community, and it is.
Right. So I'm still trying to figure out what if that is the top priority. How do you? Nobody's opposed to road maintenance, right? It's going to drain the system dry. We won't be able to do any safety unless we either A, raise a lot more money than the gas tax is ever going to, or B, decide which roads are going to crumble. Right, and maybe we have to do both. Probably we have to do both. So, what's the? You're saying safety is people's number one priority, but
I believe so.
There's the simultaneous need to make some decisions or actions on maintenance. What do you see that long term?
So I think we need to stop snowing East Portland and start delivering.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'm no great road maintenance expert, but when a street in East Portland that has a high volume of pedestrians has no sidewalk,
mm-hmm.
and we see through the crash data that people are getting killed in large volumes in certain intersections,
right.
that should be our priority.
Sure.
In my opinion.
Right. Okay, so in that case, what sacrifices are you willing to make on long-term maintenance in order to add those sidewalks?
None. We need to stop bullshitting ourselves.
Well, then where does the money come from?
Right? Well, you know, that's the great question. Where does the money come from? You know, I was the first person in this race to suggest a real source of funds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I'm elected mayor, I'm not going to sit around and wait for Salem to act. The people in Salem know me well, mm-hmm. and they know I will be pushing them hard for a transportation package. I also want to reform the way that money is spent in this state that is reliably coming into the state. There are reliable sources of funding that come in through the federal government. ODOT takes half of it off the top.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with David Bragdon, who, by the way, is a supporter of my campaign, and I'm very proud to have his support.
Mm-hmm.
We need to reallocate resources so that communities around the state get a larger portion of the funds coming from the federal government for transportation purposes, because this is where the lion's share of the problems is, in the urban areas, in Portland, in Eugene, in Medford, and in Bend.
This is relative to ODOT?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm not saying our state highways aren't important, but I would argue right now the biggest need in terms of both maintaining the infrastructure we have and improving new infrastructure, it's here.
Okay, so if the money comes from a transportation package in 2017, that's the
yes.
goal?
Yeah.
And that includes whatever they can figure out on gas
whatever,
tax or
yeah,
weight whatever,
mile, whatever
some combination.
But, you know, there's another story to be had here. Portland deliberately defunded its streets.
Mm-hmm.
That's a story I haven't heard much about. 20 years ago, the Portland City Council made a very deliberate effort to take funds that were allocated towards transportation
right.
and reallocate them to the general fund, to
sure.
other priorities. And now we're sitting here and we're acting as though we're surprised
mm-hmm.
that we don't have the resources for the kind of, you know, safety improvements, bicycle improvements, pedestrian improvements, road improvements that people want.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it is a consequence.
Even if we had that utility money, though, we wouldn't be raising $100 million a year, would we?
Probably not.
So, like, if that's the case, then don't we still need a decision? Like, it seems unlikely that the state's going to give us another $100 million a year. We still need to make some decisions about
so
which roads fall apart.
Let's start, and let's show the public that we can actually do with the resources they give us what we say we're going to do. Let's
mm-hmm.
build some credibility here first. And if we show that we are credible and we're responsible with the funds, I think they would be more inclined to support our efforts going forward. We've got to start somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
We're digging ourselves out of a very deep hole here. I mean, right now, if our, you know, collective infrastructure is a patient lying on the table,
mm-hmm.
our patient's bleeding to death.
Right.
And we've been the doctor in charge for the last 20 years, and now we're out there with the tin cup asking people to give us more money to save the patient.
Right.
I think we need to prove to them that we can begin staunching the bleeding before we ask them for a brand new operating room.
Sure, that makes sense. You said you want to take the Transportation Bureau, you know, column for the Oregonian quote you on this. I wanted to confirm that that's the case.
I'm sorry?
A column in the Oregonian quote you is saying that you wanted to take the Transportation
that,
Bureau.
That was back in August. I'm not making any decisions about any bureaus. That was an offhanded comment I made to David Saracen in a conversation we had this summer. I've not made any decisions about any bureau assignments other than the police bureau. I will take the police bureau.
Sure. Okay, great. Thanks. That's useful. The other things I wanted to talk about include the question of ridership and coverage, sort of inside versus outside, or the reductive way to put it is rich neighborhoods versus poor neighborhoods, right? So, like, you've got, if you wanted to maximize the number of people who are using things other than cars, you probably use the central city neighborhoods that were already built for pre-car transportation and invest a lot in making that super convenient. If you wanted to maximize the number of people who have the option and the socioeconomic status of those people, you'd probably invest on 122nd, having a better bike lane than nothing. Mm-hmm. Or, well, then, a piece of paint. So, what's your way of thinking about that tension? Obviously, you want to spend both places. Eventually, you're going to need to make a choice of which place a dollar goes.
May I grab us water, by the way?
Oh, yeah, please do.
Just get Ted some, too.
Yeah.
you know, it's a Sophie's choice, because ultimately you need to do both. Right. I mean, my understanding is there now are resources for separated bike lane north-south in Portland. My understanding is ODOT allocated money for that. Maybe I'm making that up.
I'm not aware of it anyway.
Okay, well, maybe.
Use these babies,
but,
right, yeah, please do. Or, yeah, I think those are probably the best. Those should be clean. Sorry, just a second.
No worries.
Yeah, if you wanted to run to the bathroom and wash it out, that's the closest source of water.
Do you need water, Ted?
I sure do.
Yeah. I was thinking you might. That's what I was considering.
Yeah,
I'm going to run to the bathroom.
Talking
okay.
for hours this week.
Don't say anything wild while I'm gone.
All right,
try.
But actually, go ahead.
You know, working class people in this community have been wronged for a long time. And I think it's important that we start making good on some of the promises that have been made over a period of decades to people in East Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And we already know that lower income people are moving farther to the east. And as I said, they're moving farther away from their place of employment. And the roads are much less safe, whether
right.
you're driving, whether you're walking, whether you're biking. I would like us to sow some good faith to the people east of 82nd by starting to improve not only their opportunities around commuting, around public transportation, around access to bikeways and sidewalks, but I think we need to demonstrate through an investment of resources. And frankly, we haven't been doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So for
so
me,
that's
I
your
think
top priority going forward.
Yes,
is walking,
yeah,
biking,
yes,
transit investments should all be east of 82nd, or not all, but
not all
the priority.
But
should be.
I'd like to show a good faith effort to do that. We
mm-hmm.
have not made that good faith investment. I mean, you know, the East Portland Action Plan, and by the way, they've made some really good headway. Amanda Fritz, I got to give her a shout out, has worked with the East Portland Action Plan group, and
mm-hmm.
she has made firm commitments and has realized many of those commitments, and
mm-hmm.
has been talking about the work around parks and some of the other things that she's been doing. I'm really appreciative of that and want to continue to work with her in that regard. But there's also a lot of things that we have not done around investing in Eastport.
Yeah.
That we should be doing. It's not just about economic opportunities, access to parks, greenways, sidewalks, transportation, public facilities, recreational opportunities. There's even a disproportionate reduction in tree canopy
mm-hmm.
in East Portland.
Right.
And there's public health disparities that exist in East Portland. I mean, there's a lot of things that we have not done that we should be doing in East Portland. That is very much part of this city, and it's been ignored for too long.
That makes sense. Speaking of that, back to development for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
You told OPB they had you walk to a neighborhood that exemplified the problem. You took them to Montevilla
mm-hmm.
and talked about how we should be developing on 82nd instead of, and that would take some of the pressure off of historic
mm-hmm.
neighborhoods like this one. What other historic neighborhoods do you think shouldn't be redeveloped? And like, how do you? Isn't there a problem if you send development to 82nd when it wants to be on 28th?
I think it is a huge mistake that you cannot reverse. If you take an historic neighborhood that has, or an historic business district that has unique architecture, and you take that unique architecture away because it's not protected
mm-hmm.
unless it's in an actual historic
right.
district,
right.
And you put in cookie cutter modern architecture, then you are robbing the community of its uniqueness.
Aren't you robbing people of their homes if you don't build it though?
What do you mean?
Well, isn't
how do you figure?
If a rich person doesn't have somewhere to move, then they move into a middle class person and so on down the line until somebody's in a tent, right?
No, I don't think by protecting our historic assets we're condemning anybody to poverty. I actually think what Montevilla shows is just the opposite is true. Montevilla is one of the few neighborhoods in this community where you can still buy a house for under $300,000.
Sure.
There aren't many left.
Yeah.
And I'm talking single family homes with a yard. And what we're seeing in Montevilla is a lot of young entrepreneurs who are locating businesses in those buildings, renovating those buildings.
Driving up the prices of the people nearby? I mean, every investment is going to cause displacement, right?
Right, so, yeah, I mean, I guess you could look at it that way, that every single time we save an historic asset, it increases the prices in the surrounding community. There's ways to mitigate that, though. And one way to mitigate it is to make sure we have a supply of workforce and affordable housing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't disagree. I just feel like it seems like there is intense pressure mm-hmm. to not change, and I totally feel this. Mm-hmm. I don't want the block across the street is going to be rezoned for R1 under the comp plan mm-hmm. Across from my house. Mm-hmm. I don't want the noisy kids to be up all night there, but I also know that, like, I helped my friend move from, 32nd and Jarrett into a tent off of 78th, and so it seems like I'm trying to get at the question, do you buy the concern that if you are prioritizing aesthetics over supply, that you're just making the problem worse?
I don't think protecting historic architecture, which is part of our history, is just about aesthetics. I think it's preserving part of who we are as a community. There's a lot of historic architecture in this community that could have been destroyed based on economic justification, like the Central Library
mm-hmm.
Could have been destroyed.
Right.
The highest and best use of that piece of property is probably a 40-story building.
Mm-hmm.
But if that had happened, we wouldn't have the trees, we wouldn't have the light, we wouldn't have the historic and unique architecture. It says something about who we are as a community. And frankly, if we're at the point where we're choosing between protecting the historic and unique character of our city and people living in tents,
mm-hmm.
we've got bigger economic problems mm-hmm. than just preserving historic architecture. That says something about jobs. It says something about housing supply. It says something about how we're zoning
mm-hmm.
for affordability. It seems to me if we should be able to preserve what's unique and special about our community's historic architecture mm-hmm. and allow people to be able to live in a decent home and put a roof over their head and feed their family. That's a complex array of questions around jobs, training, wages, education, the kind of jobs that are available. I think there's more there than just jumping from, if I choose to preserve a building by putting a small business in it, I guess my bigger view is how do we encourage improvements are going to happen, development's going to happen, can't really stop it. How do we help the community grow?
Can.
Well, how?
We just say that you have to have 6 parking spaces for every home, or you can only build 1 story, or whatever, then development will stop, right?
Oh, I thought you were talking about commercial development.
No, well, whatever.
Like
yeah,
in the
right.
Montevilla neighborhood.
Sure.
I mean, we can't, it's still America.
We recently met with a group in Northwest, and their concern is that if you take down a historic building that's 7 stories tall,
mm-hmm.
replace it with one that's 22 stories tall,
mm-hmm.
You increase the cost of housing all around it, or
right.
buildings,
right.
and you actually displace people. And
okay.
so they pushed back on the notion a little bit that every time you say you want to save an historic building, you're talking about the preservation of a neighborhood, which a lot of people see as NIMBYism or in worst cases, racism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you don't want to see
sure.
the character of the neighborhood, right? You're familiar with this.
Well, I think we're going pretty far if we say, preserve the unique business district in Montevilla were somehow racist. I mean, I think that's a preposterous leap of logic. The reality is you have a lot of young entrepreneurs who've come in and they've put, there's 2 young women. I've gone in and toured their garment factory. They're part of a movement to try and bring garment manufacturing back to America and back to Portland, and they hire recent immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
to be their employees, because they've found
That's
a lot
awesome.
Of people
who
who you know have a lot of skills in this community, and they're looking for work, and they're providing employment. You know, there's some venerable institutions on that street, like the Nonpartisan Cafe, and they've been a great supporter of workers' rights, mm-hmm. and have
love that cafe.
Been really good to people. There's some new, there's a microbrewery down there. There's some new businesses in the area. There's a food cart pod, and on balance, I think they're doing a really good thing for the community.
Yeah.
And if we're raising prices to the point where people are moving into tents, I think we're missing the step of how do we as a community preserve and protect affordable housing. And